Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Dharma Path, A Path to Self-Recognition by Eric Weinberg. When the Buddha became enlightened, he realized that all beings have the same nature and potential for enlightenment, known as Buddha nature. This is a talk about the impact contemplation in daily practice has in our minds getting used to their own nature, Buddha nature. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. So the Dharma Talk this morning, what I'm hoping to be able to do, we'll see if I get too long-winded or something, is to just give you a couple ideas about this subject regarding this path we're on called the Dharma as a path to self-recognition. One of the things, I've been around the Dharma now since the mid-90s, so it's a while, and you know, I should probably be further along than I am. One of the things about all that is that a lot of presentations are made, and they say, well, if you're the best practitioner, you should have this kind of view and this kind of practice. If you're a medium in-betweener, you should have this kind of view and this kind of practice. And then if you're the least practitioner, you start here. Being an egomaniac and an American and all that kind of stuff, I always want, you know, to go right for the gusto, right for the best. But there's a problem with that. And it took me a long time to figure this out. I saw a meme this week that illustrates that problem. And that meme was, it showed two ladders, one with a really high rung and then nice spaces between the rungs on the left, and then one with very manageable steps on the right. And the guy on the left was jumping and missing and jumping and missing and jumping and missing and essentially never getting anywhere. Meanwhile, the guy on the left, who could actually reach the first step and the second and the third and the fourth, was way up the ladder. So what I thought of was, while I tend to gravitate towards the highest view or whatever, it might be most useful to start where we are and to take the steps we can take. And I looked at my own daily practice, the parts that actually seem to benefit me in my day-to-day life. And I decided that I give you a little bit of background for the thinking behind it, but then also that I'd share just the way I approach my own practice in the morning, because it's baby steps. I think that was in a movie too. Wasn't it with Richard Dreyfuss or something like that? So, but before we start, as usual, let's start by chanting the refuge prayer. We chant it three times, and I'd like to give you a little assignment for each of the times. For the first chant, I want you to think of all these things being inherent in your world. Enlightenment is inherent in your world. And a path to enlightenment is inherent in your world, and a group of friends ordinary and realized are also in your world, and they're all pulling for you. So that's the first time. The second time through, think about how all of that really exists already within you, at least as potential, if nothing else. And we'll be talking a little bit about potential this morning. And then the third time through, think about how this all exists also in everybody else, all the people that you love, all the people that you hate, all the people that you don't even care about, everyone having all of that. So that's one of the ways to approach this three times repetition as a practice. So this morning, if you can do it, it'll fit in with the talk. Sanje Chudam Suki Chognam La Changchu Partu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jinso Gipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudam Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudam Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gipe Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Drupar Sho. Okay. Well, I wrote some notes. The first thing I want to start out with is a quote from Albert Einstein, of all people. He said, "A human being is part of the whole, called by us the universe, is a part that appears to be limited in time and space. Our being experiences itself as thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison, restricting the mind to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." That describes, I think, very precisely what the path of liberation is aiming at. And so what happens? Well, we wake up in the morning from being asleep, and for the most of us who aren't, you know, lucid while we dream or sleep, we don't know where we've been. I mean, we appear in our bed, we don't even know for sure right away where we are, and the first thing we know, our mental GPS kind of locates us. It's like, okay, I'm at home, I'm in my bed. Oh, there's Jeannie next to me, whatever, you know, all that. And then I feel a little pressure on my bladder, and I say, I better get up and go to the bathroom. And in this kind of flood of experience, just happening all in a moment, I get a sense of I am. I am thirsty, I am hungry, I need eye drops, I need to go to the bathroom, and so forth, right? And the day unfolds from there. There's that part, I need coffee, there's that part. Anyway, I am is what happens first. By the time we are aware of anything that's going on. And all of that experience, we think of as objective reality, but really, it's driven 100% by our preferences, what we like, what we don't like, what our propensities are, what our habits are. And we've built all that stuff to try to make this sense of separate self comfortable in this world, get ready for the day so the day will be okay, which, as we all know, sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. The sense of I am actually has a Latin word that we all use, and it's ego. That's what ego means in Latin. It, of course, has gotten more and more elaborate definitions over time, but really, when you boil it right down, is I take myself as experiencing everything else. There's me and all the rest of it, right? So this is the state we're just in. It's kind of like the given of being a human being. And that's what we're working with. So when Buddhism, I'm paraphrasing Trolog Rinpoche, one of our really great teachers. He said, when Buddhism speaks about overcoming ego, we should not think that it is about trying to break down one's concept of oneself, knocking the self again and again so that eventually one is left with nothing. That is not the idea at all. To overcome ego does not mean that the self is not important. It means that we have some work to do on our relationship to it and to have a better understanding of it. These are my words now. I don't know if Trolog would own them. The idea that came to me when I read that was that we seem to let this sense of self, this ego, drive the car, the vehicle of our life, and it's not a very good driver. It's hampered, very hampered. It actually has blindness. It's blinded by our habits. It's blinded by our even deeper propensities, you know, just our tendencies. And that's the way we kind of go through things. We react all day long based on our habits. And if we have good habits, you know, whatever they call that thing, the seven habits of highly effective whatevers, okay, you might not crash and burn as much. If you have bad habits, you might crash and burn a lot. But this whole thing is guided by a very limited view of what myself is and what I can accomplish and all that kind of jazz. what the Buddha taught, these habits, by definition, are blinders at the very best. What really has vision are potentials. So, generally, our reactivity, me reacting to seeing something I don't like, for instance, is fueled by my worldview, my self-concept, my habits, propensities. All those things are running the show. And then, on top of that, what the Buddha said is we mistake that for a self. So he's not saying the self doesn't exist, he's just saying that is a delusion. That thing that we construct out of what people label us as, what we judge ourselves as, and all of that, we don't know where that comes from any more than we know where dreams come from. We don't know where it goes when it leaves us and changes any more than we know the way dreams are operating. And so what practice becomes, if you enter the spiritual path in general and the Dharma path in particular, is identifying what your actual potential is and begin working with that. So let me give you an example. There'll be two examples, one at the very end. This example is something that I just read last week, and they were talking about, okay, you're asleep at night, and you hear glass breaking on your first floor, and you hear somebody in your house rummaging around looking for something, probably trying to steal something. What do you do? Well, do you grab for a gun or a baseball bat or something like that? That's one reaction. And if you really think of this person down there as violating you, you might do that. And of course, you can cause a real mess in your life and their life if you react that way, but it happens all the time. Or you could see that person as somebody in need, maybe a drug addicted child of yours who's been living on the street and has run out of food and doesn't have anywhere to turn, so they decide that they're going to come to this familiar place and find the pin money in order to go get some food or even some more drugs. Then what? Do you see it that way? And I thought to myself, there it is. If we're not clairvoyant, for instance, and we're just reacting out of our sense of, you know, threat to our personal space, we're likely to make some mistakes. That's an extreme example, but it is an example. It's like driving down the street and making a mistake, changing lanes without a turn signal and pissing somebody off, and then they chase you down and try to run you off the road. That's not good. That happens, you know? It's happened to me. Or being on the other end and being really angry at somebody and becoming erratic because of your anger. The other thing is, it's like, wow, that was scary. I was just cut off. I'm glad I didn't have an accident. I hope that other person's okay. Where does that response come from? Where's that come from? Well, in my view, since I'm not an enlightened being yet, it helps that if every morning I get up and I do my practice and I kind of reintroduce myself to what those potentials I have are. And that's the way I use morning practice. It's why when we said the refuge prayer three times, I was kind of inviting you to reintroduce your mind to the idea that you actually are living right now for all the flaws that you might perceive. You're living right now in the mandala of the Buddha. And then you're living right now with the potential of full realization within yourself. You have every quality and component right now that the historical Buddha had when he awakened. No different. Pure human being, literally. And there are others who have taken that path before us, and they're pulling really hard for us. And now and then we meet them in person, and now and then we just kind of realize that somebody is praying for us or something like that, and finding some way to support us in a good situation we're in, or even in a bad situation we're in. So that's where the subtle shift comes from. We're going to take the car keys away from habits and propensities that we've mistakenly called me, I, the driver. And we're going to say, you need a little more work. And we're going to give those car keys to some potential that we have. So we'll let our view of the potential for awakening to kindness and compassion and joy and complete equanimity, in other words, not treating people that we like better than people we don't like, but treating everybody with the view that they too have potential. Okay, so I forget this by the end of the day and fall asleep, and I have to remind myself every morning. That's what morning practice is. So obviously, generally, this forgetfulness actually just puts the keys to the car back into the hands of our own reactivity, which is fueled by the worldview after it's got the blinders on, and our self-concept and our habits and our propensities. And that self-grasping, that's grasping at a self. When the Buddha talks about self-grasping is the root of suffering, that's what he's talking about, grasping at that self, trying to hold on to that self as being who you are. So he said that's what the root of suffering is, and that the good thing about that is to recognize that it has a cause. And because it has a cause, it's workable. We can change the causes so that we're actually approaching this thing we call life, this precious thing we call life, in a different way. From our tradition's point of view, this potential is really just limitless openness. Some teachers call it emptiness, but I think that gets confusing. There's probably something lacking in that English translation. But think of it this way, as limitless openness, like the sky. Anything can happen in the sky. Airplanes go through it, clouds appear and disappear. It's like our life is limitlessly open and all kinds of things happen. And then we identify as, when we're with our blinders on, we identify as our reaction to the things that appear in the sky of our mind, right? And all at the same time, you know, we think that that other thing is happening to me, and that's where the delusion comes in. In morning practice, what we do is we identify with the sky, with the limitless openness. That's the nature of an enlightened mind. It can accommodate, it does accommodate everything. And then we have some options. We can decide what kind of qualities are going to fill that limitless openness so that it's not just empty, it actually has some qualities and it has some energy. Now for me, when I fill that openness with qualities, I'm thinking of the six paramitas because I know them, because I've heard them talked about a lot of time. What are they? Generosity. Generosity has a certain flavor, a certain, feeling to it. And so in practice, as I'm going through a prayer, I'm thinking about, okay, the structure, literally that I have the structure of a Buddha that actually is limitless openness, and I'm going to add a feeling tone to it. And it can be generosity and ethics and patience, joy, meditative absorption, and wisdom. Those are the six paramitas. So part of that prayer is to recall those as being a really good set of atmospheric kind of fillers for that limitless openness. That's the second thing. So we got limitless openness, and then we've got these qualities. Then there's the energies. We obviously have energy. Those energies go in all kinds of different ways, and they can go really haywire. I mean, that's what out of control lust is all about, right? Or just absolute drivenness for, your team on football Saturday or whatever. A lot of energy. Well, the energies I like to think of are the natural energies. So we've got the solidity of the earth. It's totally dependable, solid. Gravity is real. We may disagree about everything else. Even flat earthers agree that they're not, just like levitating at will. Something is keeping us grounded. So the solidity and stability of the earth, and I try to engender that energy. And then there's the humility and power of water. Water is incredible. It carves the Grand Canyon, and yet it always seeks the lowest point. It's amazing that humility can be that powerful, but it is. And the same is true on the spiritual path. We tend to want to be recognized and get a pat on the head and blah, blah, blah. But in truth, the powerful things are when we can show up, perceive what's needed, and humbly serve. And that's when things really get interesting. So in the morning, I think about the humility and the power of water. Then there's the clarity and the warmth of fire. That's what fire is. Out of control, of course, can cause some problems, but it all has these qualities of warmth and bringing light or clarity. I'm hoping that that's, for instance, what this talk does a little bit of, is to be warm and inviting and also clear. Then there's air itself, the wind. The wind is a particularly profound meditation. We do breathing meditation a lot. Here's the thing about it that has struck me recently. I breathe in, and this air doesn't care who I am. Everybody breathes in that's alive, right? And no matter who you are, whether you're doing good things or bad things or not doing anything at all, you breathe in. and it reaches you at a cellular level and gives you nourishment and life, literally, at a cellular level. Then you breathe out, and you cannot control where that exhalation that was a part of you at the cellular level, you can't control where that goes. And you're feeding everybody. You're feeding trees all the way around the other side of the world, which in turn are feeding Vladimir Putin in Russia. It's true. We're all sharing the same breath. And that's why it's really good to have kind of created this atmosphere of generosity, ethics, patience, joy, meditation, and wisdom, because you hope that puts a little spin on that air that you're sharing. And what better thing could you do than to pray for somebody who seems to be messing up really bad? What better thing could you do? So all day long, this is a way we can stay on the path, is just be aware that with our very breath, we're bringing ourself light and light from the Buddhas, from great teachers, from people we love. And we're also sharing that in a very real physical way with everybody without exception. You can see what's happening to your view when you just think about it. It's getting big. It's what the Zen teachers call big mind. And then, of course, the last thing is space. We already talked about that. All of this is happening within limitless openness. All of it. And to the degree that we kind of get used to our mind's capacity for these, for this compassionate presence, these qualities, this energy, we can rest in space. And that is actually the meditation of shamatha, is bringing our mind just to rest. So that when something comes up, we can respond. So why does this seem so hard to do? That's the question. It's like, wow, that sounds easy. Yes, we'll just do that. Well, the truth is we're not used to thinking that way. And that's what practice is all about, and that's why we call it practice. Is just for the same reason I can understand how to put a car together, right? But I better have the right parts, otherwise I'm not going anywhere. I can understand music theory, but if I don't learn to practice the piano and practice a lot running scales, I'll never make music, ever. And that's what this is. So I'm introducing some ideas, but we need some kind of practical framework to practice those ideas. That's really what we need. And then we have to have the motivation to do it, the motivation to see ourselves as potential Buddhas and to see everybody else as having that potential too. We gotta want it. So Chagdud Rinpoche, who is a great Nyingma teacher, kind of gave the progression, and I want to repeat it one time. It is a repetition, but I want to repeat it because it's important to understand it. And then we'll do a little bit of this practice that I was talking about. He says, the path begins with refuge, compassion, and watching our mind. In this space of the mind, there's no problem, no suffering. We recognize our potential to awaken, and everyone else's too, and that this mind is the linchpin. Then something captures our attention, an image, a sound, a smell, and mind splits into inner and outer, self and other, subject and object. In simply perceiving the object, there's still no problem. But when we zero in on it, we notice that it's big or small, white or black, square or circular, and we make judgments. For example, whether it's pretty or ugly. Having made that judgment, we react to it, decide I like it or don't like it. That's when the problem starts, because I like it leads to I want it. We want to possess what we perceive to be desirable. Similarly, I don't like it leads to I don't want it. If we like something, want it, and can't have it, we suffer. If we don't want it, but can't keep it away, again, we suffer. So much of life, and then my comment is, so much of life is wanting what we don't have and having what we don't want. Our suffering seems to occur because the object of our desire or aversion, but that's not really so. This is him going on. It happens because the mind loses track of its potential for kindness and compassion, splits into object-subject duality, and becomes involved in wanting reaction or not wanting reaction. All of that comes from a misperception of who we are. So in order to not be imprisoned by suffering, we meditate. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, that's the reason I'm here. That's the reason I wanted to learn to meditate. I was not happy. And Ram Dass or somebody in Be Here Now, you know, said, hey, you can work with it this way. Give it a try. I mean, that's what started it all, you know. But I didn't come to it just because it was just part of my life, like mommy and daddy or something like that. It wasn't like that at all. It was like, oh, I don't like this. So it started with that aversion to my own life. I think pretty much everybody I've ever talked to at some level comes to meditation, comes to the Dharma in that way. There's something that's just not satisfactory. And in fact, that's what the Buddha taught. It's just the nature of samsara, what he calls samsara, this cycle of having what we don't want and wanting what we don't have produces suffering. So that's why I came. And there's some kind of thing that becomes very convincing at some point that it's possible that this doesn't have to be the way it is, that there might be a different way to relate to life. And that the path involves this thing we call meditation. So, meditation. There are only two kinds of meditation when you come right down to it. First, there's calming down, and then there's waking up. That's it. You can't wake up until you calm down. So, we work on that first. Because waking up is where we actually engage our potential. Buddha means one who is awakened. That's it. It's not a big, complicated thing. So here's what I do. I get up in the morning. I have a little meditation space in my house. I would say that that's a good thing to have. And I do what we call opening my shrine, which means making some offerings, usually some water, or one of the bowls has a little saffron in it, stuff like that. And then I do the same kind of refuge prayer that we just did three times with exactly that same kind of contemplation, where the first part of the contemplation is recognizing, there is such a thing as awakened ones, and I'm going to take refuge in that instead of taking refuge in what I think I can get out of life if I massage it just right. That's the game. Usually what happens is we spend all our time trying to figure out how to play it just right so we get what we want and avoid what we don't want. What the Buddha taught was the whole system is designed to be unsatisfactory. You're going to do it just right, expect a pat on the head, and get a slap in the face. This is going to happen. Sometimes you'll get a pat on the head. It's very inconsistent. You don't know what's what, which is what. You don't know. The only thing that's dependable, is this transformation of mind as a field for these six perfections. And it's doable. So we take refuge in the potential or the actual realization of the historical Buddha, who is an exemplar, and the Dharma, which is his teachings, and the Sangha, which are the people that have gone before that have actually also accomplished this potential, this goal. The second time through, then, really contemplating as I say it, not just mouthing the words, which is way too easy, and a lot of people, I fear, do that. It's not like they're magic words, frankly. I don't think the Buddha taught magic words. That's not what his teaching was about. So, really contemplate that you, as a human being, have all the same equipment that Buddha had. And in fact, if you read any history or anything like that, you realize that we actually have a lot more, complexity in our world, but we also have a lot easier time. We don't have to go down to the river to fetch water. Just that. Some places in the world we still do, but here, you go into the kitchen and turn the faucet. I mean, really, so many things that necessarily, just to keep life alive, were required at the time of the historical Buddha are not required of us. We have more, actually, freedom. And it's probably, good to recognize that anyway. Regardless, we've got the same equipment personally, physically. We were born with the same kind of mind, the same kind of body, etc., that the Buddha was born with. So we can actually use it to awaken. It's really important. The Dharma, something internal, something that if we practice well, rather than simply being a slave to our reactions, simply letting them drive us around, the Dharma can now be the chauffeur. Interesting, right? Much better vehicle, I gotta tell you. Not so shaky. Much fewer crashes and so forth. And the internal Sangha is, this is really interesting. There's a certain level of the teachings where they say that all the peaceful and wrathful deities actually are in our bodies. That's a whole other subject. We're not going to get in there. But you can recognize that all is energy, right? And it's all in there. So that's the second repetition. And the third, once you get there, is just relaxing. Resting like somebody who truly has refuge. Not somebody who's got to get somewhere, you're already there. Resting in it, getting used to it, being like that, okay? So, this took me, I don't know, 5 minutes to describe, but it'll take you about a minute and a half to do. It's not a big, hairy deal. But if you really use it as a guided meditation, you'll start to get used to it, and the switch will start to get turned. Lama Kathy likes to talk about, for instance, that anger isn't something that we extinguish and get rid of. It's more like turning a switch. It's like anger's just a reaction. We can look at the same stimulus for that reaction, and if we have kindness and compassion as the atmosphere in our mind, our reaction to the same situation can be patience. And if we do that again and again and get used to it, it's transformative. That's what we're talking about. So, I have offerings and refuge. And then for me, I do the Tashi prayer. Why? Well, I just like it. And I memorized it a long time ago when I thought that it was actually magical words. I did. I mean, you know, we all go through it. It's got very, very good qualities. Kathy Jackson gave a great talk on it a couple weeks ago. And you can use a whole lot of it. Choose a practice. All the practices I'm aware of actually have these four parts. So I'm going to go through the four parts. I think for those of us who just need to make baby steps, rather than try to hold this all as wisdom as opposed to something that's just, you know, magical thinking, is too hard. So you choose a prayer that's actually offered to us by an enlightened being. Tashi prayer is a good example of that. And here's how that Tashi prayer goes. It's really interesting. So it's got four parts, right? It's four or five. We'll count them as I go through. The first part, though, is naming all these Buddhas, not just Shakyamuni, but all kinds of Buddhas, like I think it's eight, something like that. And as I'm chanting this Tashi prayer, I'm saying the words, right? But rather than thinking about the names of the Buddhas, honestly, and this is just what I do, so I'm actually thinking, I'm the ninth one. I have the same equipment they have. And so I'm chanting those stanzas, naming the eight Buddhas, okay? But I'm identifying with it, and that's what I mean. Practice in the morning particularly can be reintroducing yourself to your own potential. It's important. And then the next stanza is the eight bodhisattvas. Well, the eight bodhisattvas represent the qualities, the perfections, these perfections. So I start and I'm like, okay, Buddha, framework. It's like sometimes I imagine it's like a set of tubes inside my body. Okay, it's openness, tubes in my body, Buddha. Now we're going to fill those tubes with an atmosphere. Okay, good. What's the atmosphere going to be? Well, it's going to be generosity. And the atmosphere is going to be ethics. And it's going to be patience and joy. And the atmosphere is going to be meditative absorption. I want to be able to rest my mind and not be just reactive all over the place. And wisdom, so that when I do respond, I'm responding from the point of view of whatever I'm responding to, having the potential for great qualities, or if it's a person or an animal, has potential for awakening. It's like, wisdom. So I'm filling all those tubes or whatever this is, this Buddha body, with this atmosphere. And then the next thing is the next stanza is it names dakinis. Now dakinis often are related to energy. And energy is really important. And so I use those energies that I mentioned, and because it's easy for me to remember. We're always engaged with the earth, okay? The energy of solidity, being there, solid. Humility and power, like water. Warmth and clarity, like fire. Nourishing everything. Even my enemies, like air, and great openness within which all of that manifests. Okay. Then there's one more stanza that's also naming things, the fourth one that names things. And it names the protectors. Well, protectors are related to activity. It's what you're doing. This is really interesting. They're saying that the four activities of a Buddha are pacification, enrichment, magnetization, and subduing. What I found in my life since I've started contemplating this is those are specific, and they go in a specific order. And if I enter a situation, and I have kind of, I don't have to think about all this, because it's like I try to inject it and make it the atmosphere of my mind, then it just gives me an order of operations. If I get into a situation that seems difficult, first I can try to pacify it. That might not work. Then I might try to enrich it. Maybe this is a little wonky or difficult because somebody needs something they don't have, and I can figure out how to give it to them. Maybe it's just comfort, a hand to hold, instead of maybe advice or some like crazy words that I have, you know, just. enriching somehow. Magnetization. So if enriching doesn't work, you want that person to grab on to what's going to be good and helpful for themselves. So you make it attractive. Maybe it's a little bit of salesmanship. I don't know. But something like that. And then if it's just like karma's going to happen and you can't get the thing to move through pacification, enriching, or magnetization, then you just got to stop it. A little like if a kid is about to put a fork in a light plug, you kick the kid's hand if that's, you know, because they're low to the ground, they're munchkins. You kick, and they'll cry, and they won't understand that you did something mean, but you saved their life probably, or at least kept them from a problem. That's subduing. So in the four stands, I think about the four activities I'll be involved in the day. Right? And then when you're all done with that, you finally end the Tashi prayer, then you get to the request. That's when you're just praying to whoever you're praying to, which says, with all obstacles and harmful influences pacified, may the work we are now about to begin meet with the ever-growing fulfillment and success and bring good fortune, prosperity, happiness, and peace. So you finally get to the prayer after you do those four stanzas. This is a beautiful thing. I encourage you to check it out. Dedicate the merit and move on my way. I know I've talked about it for a little while, but this isn't, once you get used to it, this isn't something that takes a long time, but it can go very deep when you're consistent with it. And for me, it's been one of the most useful tools I've ever encountered, and it's helped my life. So I wanted to share it with you. We have just a couple minutes left. I was going to read you an allegory or something. We have a couple minutes, but we won't have time. We have a couple minutes left, so if there are a few questions, I'm happy to try to answer anything that you might have come up for you.
Feels weird when my legs fall asleep like that.
Mine do that all the time.
Yeah, I wasn't even expecting that. But you mentioned that the Buddha did not teach magic words.
Did not teach what, sorry?
Magic words.
Oh, yeah, magic words, right. Mm-hmm.
Just from my lack of knowledge, what are mantras?
Mantras, it depends on what you think of as magic. Mantras are what we call skillful means. They're actually very, very evocative of these energies and qualities. So, for instance, Om Mani Padme Hum, right? So each one of those syllables has a resonance to it. I mean, that's the nature of sound, right? And it sends a resonance both in your own heart and in the hearts of, well, like I said, everything traveling through the air really goes everywhere in this world. It goes everywhere, and each of those resonances are said to create the causes and conditions needed to liberate beings that are in each of the realms of samsara. So it's not just that this magically happens, they're actually setting up a sympathetic energy in the world. So I wouldn't consider, I suppose some people try to use mantras like magic, and I don't think the mantras care. And as far as I know, they're still going to be effective because the resonance is there. But they're much more powerful if you have an understanding of what the mantra is and what it does, and apply it within this mental atmosphere of openness and kindness and compassion. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, if there are no other questions, that was a good question. Thank you. I actually knew that one was coming too. Rather than doing the traditional dedication, I'd like to read you a dedication that was written by Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, the founder of our center, that I found, and it really kind of, I think, brings together all these points that we were talking about this morning. So just take a breath and listen to these words and mentally dedicate the merit of having come here this morning in that way. So now, the time has come that we share the good that may have happened while we were here. This process and the roots of goodness, as it is said, that which when we share are the cause for further goodness to arise. We all dedicate and freely invest in all other sentient beings that are filling the whole space of the universe, wherever they are, and joining in with a wish that this inbuilt potential of ours for full enlightenment may come to fruition at the same time that all the ones that we have a connection to will reach together this liberation in this one body and lifetime, so that we be of great use for all sentient beings. So let's join in that prayer of dedication. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.